Young, it's here and now. For the first time in 26 years, Pope John Paul II did not attend the Good Friday procession at the Colosseum in Rome today, nor did the ailing Pope hear the confessions of the faithful at St. Peter's Basilica. Good Friday, of course, is the solemn day when Christians remember the death of Jesus by crucifixion. This year's the Pope's message was sent to worshipers by video. Paddy Agnew is Vatican correspondent for the Irish Times. He joins us on the line from Rome. And Paddy, can you start by giving us the latest on the Pope's health?
The latest is that the Pope is not well. I mean, I'm sure all your listeners know that he's been struggling with ill health for many years now, but it appears to have got quite dramatically worse, particularly in the wake of the tracheotomy operation. That's an operation on his windpipe to help breathing, which he had on February 24th. He came out of hospital about 10 days ago, and on the three public appearances he's made, three very brief appearances that he has made since then, he's looked weaker, he's looked gaunt, he's in no shape to take any active part in the Easter celebrations this weekend.
Well, and today was the first time he's ever failed to appear in person for the Good Friday procession. That's in his 26 years as Pope. How are people reacting there?
Well, nobody's surprised in the sense that everybody's been well aware of his state of health, or indeed of ill health. And the faithful who are here in Rome, even tourists, I think people just feel a lot of sympathy for somebody who's at the age of 84 and after a very complex medical track record and suffering from arthritis and Parkinson's disease, is struggling and doing his, setting an extraordinary example of how to deal with sickness and illness in old age.
Well, issues of end of life dominated the U.S. media this week because of the case of Terry Schiavo. Now, Paddy, one time some Catholic priests were saying that her feeding tube should be removed because she couldn't have a friendship with God, to quote just one priest. But then this Pope surprised the Church by declaring last year that feeding tubes should not be removed, that assisted hydration and food should be considered ordinary care. What has he said about his own health? Has he said anything about whether he would want to be kept alive by artificial measures if and when a time came?
No, he hasn't. What he has said, though, is he, as Pope, has been put on the seat of Peter by God and can only be taken off the seat of Peter by God. Or, as he put it another way, Christ did not step down from the cross. And what he was saying there is that, people who look at me and see that I'm, not in good health and I'm an old man now and call on me to resign haven't understood the nature of pontifical office.
So there's no talk of the Pope stepping down?
No, I mean, it simply wouldn't. It's never going to happen with this Pope. He's not the sort of guy who's ever going. He's not the resigning type of guy. And many people in the Vatican over the years have said this is a guy who'll go out with his boots on.
Paddy Agnew, Vatican correspondent for the Irish Times. He spoke to us from Rome. Paddy, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to Iraq. The U.S. military forces in Iraq confirmed today that a suicide bomber in Ramadi killed 11 Iraqi policemen and three civilians yesterday evening at a checkpoint on the outskirts of the city. Also yesterday, unidentified attackers killed five Iraqi women in Baghdad. The women worked for the U.S. military. It's been just over 2 years since U.S. troops invaded Iraq and drove Saddam Hussein from power. As we enter year three, we're taking time to take stock. In a moment, two American fathers who lost sons with very different opinions about the conflict. But first, Borzu Daragahi. He's covered the Iraq story extensively for Here and Now, the Boston Globe, and others. And Borzu, welcome.
Thanks a lot.
And let's review some of the statistics as we enter year three. The number of Iraqi dead is unknown, but the estimates range from 17,000 to 100,000. Over 1,500 American soldiers and civilians have been killed. But is there a sense in Iraq that the Bush administration's gamble may be paying off?
I mean, it depends on who you talk to completely. You know, for Iraq's Kurds, for example, it's totally paid off. They're the winners of history, of Iraqi history, for the first time ever. The Shia are about to take control of Iraq for the first time ever. But for, large swaths of the country, maybe not the majority, it's been a disaster in their eyes.
Despite that, as you write, year two was a time of political and economic successes, including the handover of sovereignty, the staging of elections, the growth of the consumer economy, and the increase in public salaries.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, the public salaries used to be so low under Saddam Hussein. You know, we're talking $2-3 a month. Now they're, $150, $200 a month. They have a little bit more money to spend.
You've also written for the New York Times that Iraq's long-suffering financial industry has been, as you put it, creaking to life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the under Saddam Hussein, most of the banking industry was state-owned and operated. After the first Gulf War, he allowed some private banks to open up. They weren't able to do much, but now they're starting to. You know, you can get money into Iraq now. I have a bank account at the Bank of Baghdad, which is a private bank, and when I need money, I just have it wired to the Bank of Baghdad. It takes a week, but it's still possible, and that's a big change.
But you also write that for you to personally go to the bank is often to risk your life.
Absolutely. That's one of the ironies of life in Iraq, you know, the danger and the security issues involved. I'll give you a really good example. I went to this shop. It's called the Beirut, and it's this clothing store where women are shopping and so on, you know, modern, sexy outfits. But the women are too scared to wear any of them. You know, they buy them and just kind of keep them in their closet because the security situation is such as they wouldn't dare walk out with anything that's in that store.
There have been many murders of women lately who have dared. Well, the Times also reported that a Shiite carpenter in Baghdad foiled an attack by insurgents. He opened fire and killed three of the insurgents. Is there a sense that the people in Iraq are taking a stand?
Well, I don't know. I read that article. I thought it was just kind of miscast. To me, I thought it was very sad. I didn't see it as like, you know, the turning the corner or something like that. They put it into some positive spin. But, I mean, think about that. You know, people are taking the law into their own hands and, you know, getting into running gun battles with criminals in the streets. That doesn't sound like a country moving to democracy. That sounds like a country sinking more into a chaos.
What about the people's psyche and their physical well-being? How many injured are there in Iraq? How are the hospitals functioning? How are they patching people back together?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I'm actually working on a big feature about, you know, Baghdad ER. And the doctors that I speak to, the ER technicians, the hospital administrators, say that, you know, in many ways things have improved since the end of the war. They have access to better equipment. They have access to better drugs. They're not under sanction anymore. They don't have to smuggle in cancer drugs as they did because of the UN-imposed sanctions. On the other hand, because of the security issues, you know, the amount of violence that's plaguing the country, they're constantly dealing with these very, very draining, time-consuming trauma injuries. And, you know, this is really taking a toll on the medical industry there. They're just multiple, think about a car bomb. You know, you have like 30 people who have, you know, these horrible wounds. There's another issue in that there's a huge kidnapping wave targeting, wealthy and successful Iraqis. So many of the best doctors in the country, you know, they're leaving the country.
Yeah. Well, but overall, Borzoo, having spent time there and really poked below the surface, where do you think Iraq is headed in year three?
That's a really good question. It's a really hard question. It's very unpredictable. Iraq is, you know, in many ways, is still a very fragile situation. While, you know, we may be, the Americans may be patting themselves on the back for this election and so on, we should not forget the real stabilizing force in Iraq at this point is a 75-year-old Iranian cleric named Ayatollah Ali Sistani. And, I don't mean to be, like, you know, blithe about it, but, like, one bullet to the back of his head could cause a civil war. And that's not so far off the mark that could happen. Because this is a guy who's basically keeping the majority of the country in check. Every time
the Shiites.
The majority Shiites of the country, exactly. And, you know, every time there's a car bomb, typically a car bomb is directed at, you know, a Shiite young man lining up to volunteer for the army or the police. There's, after every one of these car bombs, there's, like, cries for retribution and revenge against the Sunni Arabs and by the Shia. And it's Sistani and his deputies who say, absolutely not, revenge is un-Islamic. We will not allow, you know, this country to move in that direction. You are not to take revenge. And cooler heads prevail.
In fact, I believe you've said that what works is when Americans sort of step aside and let Ali Sistani take charge.
It seems that's happened. I mean, it seems that, you know, he's outmaneuvered everybody. You know, he outmaneuvered Bremer, he outmaneuvered Alawi, he outmaneuvered Negroponte. You know, the U.S. thought that they were getting enough votes to put in Alawi again as a prime minister. But, you know, Sistani's list totally outmaneuvered them.
But overall, what do you think this year holds?
You know, so many journalists are out there playing pundit, and I don't, you know, I'm loath to do that. But I think one possibility, one scenario that could come about is a sort of a Shia Saudi Arabia, where the Americans get their bases, the international oil gets access to the oil fields, and the Shia clergy get control over people's social lives. With the Kurds, of course, having their little liberal free trade zone up in the north.
Borzu Daragahi is a reporter based in the Middle East. He's been filling us in on the last 2 years and the future of Iraq. Borzu, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, a recent poll asked Americans about the war in Iraq. 53% of respondents said the war was not worth fighting. 70% said the number of U.S. casualties, including over 1,500 deaths, was an unacceptable price. Well, we thought we'd reconnect with two fathers who paid that price, with the lives of one of their sons. We begin with Michael Berg. He's the father of Nicholas Berg, the contractor who was kidnapped and beheaded in May of 2004. Michael joins us on the line from New Jersey. And we last spoke an hour before you found out about your son's fate. How have you been doing?
Well, at the time, I was very reluctant to talk to any media, but I've since changed my opinion about that and decided that speaking out against the war is so important that I had to put that personal preference behind myself. And as far as how I'm doing, I guess it just pretty much depends on what day it is. I think what happened to my son will be on my mind when I die and all the time in between. Mm-hmm.
But we have seen in the last year elections in Iraq, an economy that's booming, at least for some, the fall of a despot. Does any of that make you feel that maybe your son's death might have led to a greater good? Is there any sense of that anywhere in there?
Well, George Bush said a couple of days ago on television that he thought it was all worth it. And I'm asking him, what was it worth to him? What did he lose? Nothing is worth it. My own personal freedom isn't worth having lost my son. I'd gladly give that up if I could have him back. And as for having democracy in Iraq, I certainly hope that you don't believe that there is a democracy even beginning in Iraq. And that whole ballot, that whole election was set up by people appointed by an occupying army. And as far as economy is concerned, I am in touch with people in Iraq, and I know what the economy is like. People I know are still hungry. These are college professors.
How do you feel about the people who killed your son?
Well, it depends on which ones you mean. As far as the people who were pictured in the videotape, I would love to see them captured. I would love to see them separated from the rest of society so that they can't do what they did to my son and have done since over and over and over again.
Michael Berg, he's the father of Nicholas Berg, an American civilian contractor brutally killed in Iraq in May of 2004. Well, who else does Michael blame for his son's death? And also a father with a very different opinion about the war. Stay right there. There's much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our catch-up with Martin Berg. His son, Nicholas Berg, was taken hostage, beheaded in Iraq. And Martin, you just said you blame the al-Qaeda insurgents primarily for your son's death and others. Who?
The people that I really blame for my son's death are George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Alberto Gonzalez, because they are the ones that are responsible for the destabilization of Iraq, which let al-Qaeda came in, which supposedly killed my son. And they're also responsible for the atrocities at Abu Ghraib prison. And my son was supposedly murdered in retaliation for those atrocities.
There have been many kidnappings and executions since your son's. I can't imagine what it was like for you to, watch from the sidelines.
Well, to tell you the truth, whenever I heard that someone was kidnapped, I was sitting almost as far to the edge of my seat as when my own son was missing, and I would listen and I would listen and I would listen to the news to try and hope that a good outcome would come. And then when it didn't, in the cases where it didn't, it was really like reliving the whole thing all over again.
Michael Berg, if 10, 20 years down the line, there's peace in that region, there's a blossoming democratic Iraq, there's a Palestinian state living in harmony next to Israel, there's human rights, women's rights in Saudi Arabia, and historians attribute this to the Bush administration. Will that make your son's death any less in vain?
No. There is nothing that would make my son's death less in vain. And as far as the Palestinians are concerned, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, if there were peace on earth sometime down the line, I guarantee you it won't be for George Bush's efforts.
Michael Berg, father of slain hostage Nicholas Berg. Well, we now turn to Ron Griffin. His son Kyle was killed in a truck accident on the road to Mosul early in the war. And Ron, when we last talked to you, you were adamant that your son's death was worth it. Half a year on, do you feel the same way?
I'm gonna preface that, and I'm not. If he asked me the question straight out, and if I was to answer it, I would say absolutely, positively, without question. But over the last year, I've actually thought about it. I don't even know if we have the right to ask that question. Hmm. Reason being, Kyle made that decision, not me. He decided what he wanted to do was to be a soldier. If he made the decision, he thought it was worth it. I don't know if I really have the right to ask the question, because then I say, well, did he do something wrong? Isn't he capable of making a decision? I'll give you an analogy. You get 10 surgeons. They decide, are we going to operate or not operate? We're going to operate or we're not going to operate. Six of them say, we have to operate. The other four can't go into the operating room saying, well, you got to stop. Once the decision is made, then everything has to be done to get that patient through the operation. I think it's the same thing here. Once we made that decision, if you agree with it or disagree with it, and the soldiers volunteered, they said it was worth it.
Well, let me ask it another way.
Okay.
How do you feel the war effort has gone?
Actually, I think the war effort is going very well right now, and the reason why is I sat down on my computer coming home from work, and you usually get home at like 12:30 every night, and go on all the websites. I couldn't find a story on Iraq. There was nothing there. Nobody was killed. Maybe it's just they're getting so used to it and they're getting complacent with it, or they're just realizing, well, maybe things are getting better.
Some would say soldiers are killed every week, Iraqis are killed
right
every week, and maybe that's a bad thing that we're not recognizing that.
I would agree. I was in Vietnam. One of the things I've always noticed is that we as a country, either the press or the people, we seem to place a greater price on our life than we do the people that's over there. Mm. I've always found that to be wrong. Anybody dying over there is bad. But in the world we live in, people kill each other. And there's got to be somebody who's got to try to stop it. I don't know any other way of doing it.
How do you live your life now? You said you went on the websites at night to look and see what was going on. Do you find yourself following every tick, the battling in Fallujah, the killing of insurgents recently?
Oh, absolutely. I can recite what the war's resolution actually says. I can tell you I've seen this floor speeches on C-SPAN. I have a father that I met through the internet who's down in Alabama. His son was in the truck behind my son when Kyle was killed. And his son is back in Iraq again. He says every morning he wakes up at 3 o'clock. He goes on the internet to see if he got an email from his son, and then he looks down the road to see if there's a car parked down there waiting to wake him up in the morning to tell him his son has been killed. That is what he does every single day. That's what we all do. We go on the internet, we see what's happening. It's sometimes horrible.
But some people, Ron, would say it would move them to despair, that it would point to them, you know, that this war has not gone the way the Bush administration said it would, and it would make them angry.
Yes, and no war has gone the way it's supposed to go. Everything gets screwed up. People make mistakes. It doesn't necessarily mean that what's going on is not going to have a good ending. I stood in front of my TV and cried a couple of months after Kyle died. I was watching, if I remember correctly, it was in Aqaba. You had the King of Jordan, the now again Prime Minister of Palestine, President Bush, and the Prime Minister of Israel standing there, and I'm crying, and my wife says, "Why are you crying?" I said, "Because Kyle and his buddies made this happen. The world has changed." Think of this. Someday a girl and a guy can sit down and have coffee in Haifa and not worry about a suicide bomber, and a little girl can go to school wherever she wants in Baghdad.
You believe that
absolutely.
The fall of Saddam Hussein led to what we're seeing happen in the Middle East?
Oh, absolutely.
What do you say to people who say, and Nick Berg's father is one of them, who say, actually, it's worse. The world is less safe.
See, I don't know that for a fact. My son, for whatever reason, he died. I can tell you right now that something good will come from that. How? Why? I don't know.
Ron Griffin's son, Kyle, was killed in May of 2003, one of over 1,500 Americans killed in Iraq. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Young, it's here and now. This week in Minnesota, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss went on a shooting rampage with his grandfather's guns. After killing 9 people, Weiss then shot himself. Last weekend in Boston, in a period of less than 24 hours, 3 people were shot to death in 3 separate incidents. Earlier this month, an armed man opened fire at a church service in Wisconsin, killing 7 before killing himself. And before that, a federal judge's husband and mother were gunned down in Chicago by a man who was angry about a decision the judge had made. Question, would tougher gun control laws have prevented any of these shootings? David Hemenway is a professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health. He's author of the book Private Guns, Public Health, and he spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Professor, let me ask you, first of all, from your point of view, what is it we're doing wrong when it comes to preventing gun violence?
Well, a big thing is that we make it really easy for anyone to get guns in the United States. We have very different laws compared to virtually any other developed country. All other developed countries have much, much less gun violence problems, and they have licensure laws at the national level, registration for handgun laws, safe storage laws, laws that you need some training before you can get a gun, and so forth and so on.
You emphasize a public health approach to curbing gun violence. What's that mean?
I think there are 3 principal aspects to a public health approach. One is that it's about prevention. We're trying to just prevent things from happening. The second thing is that you're not looking for fault. You're not trying to say who's to blame. All you're trying to do is prevent. And the third thing is you're not looking at trying to understand why Joe killed Jane. You're trying to understand populations. You're trying to understand why we're killing 80 people a day with guns in the United States, and how to reduce that to 70 people, and how to reduce that to 60 and 50. You're trying to understand why some states have very low rates of violent death because they have low rates of firearm death, and other states have very high rates, and how to reduce the rates in all areas.
You talk about focusing on the guns.
I think it's really important to focus on lots of aspects of injury and violence. One of the things it's very important is the means. The same way in the automobile area, when we're looking at how do you reduce motor vehicle deaths, you want to look at drivers, you want to look at the roads, but you also want to look at the cars. And one of the things I've been focusing on is the agent of injury, which often is the gun.
Well, in cars, you make the doors stronger, you put the airbags in, you create better restraint system, and you're an advocate of redesigning guns.
I'm an advocate of redesigning guns. I'm an advocate of making it so when you take out the clip, you can tell whether or not there's a bullet in the chamber. I'm an advocate of making it so it's really hard for criminals to obliterate serial numbers on guns, to make it so we can trace guns easier. I'm also an advocate in terms of the distribution of guns. Right now, we have a whole lot of guns sold on the secondary market where there's no background checks, there's no waiting period. And so terrorists can get guns, criminal kids can get guns, adolescents can easily get guns.
Has the public health approach been tried? Does it work? Will it work?
It certainly works in lots of areas that we know of. It's worked very well, for example, in the motor vehicle area where no one thinks drivers are any better than they were 50 years ago, and yet motor vehicle deaths per mile driven have fallen 85%. It's worked. It's working very well. It's not as well as we hope, but still it's big successes in the tobacco area where we have much, much lower rates of cancer now than we used to have without banning cigarettes in the same way we didn't ban cars. And I think it's worked in a whole variety of areas, yes.
In a recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine, you wrote, quote, if shooters were determined, resourceful people with clear and sustained deadly intent, then regulating guns would have little effect on the number of homicides and suicides. They would find a way.
I think that's true. But a lot of people who commit suicide, it turns out it's spontaneous. I mean, this kid in the school shooting, this was a suicide. A lot of people are not determined. Most people who kill somebody else, they're not like hitmen all the time. If they can get through a period in their lives, if it doesn't, if it's not sort of a terrible thing happening at the moment, they won't kill.
So you're saying even if we effect some change, it's not going to stop this?
No, it will reduce it. What I'm trying to say is that what we can see is in Canada and Australia and New Zealand and all the developed Europe. Is that they have more reasonable gun laws, and yes, occasionally they have problems, but at a much, much lower level. The same way in the automobile area, it's not like airbags save everybody. There's still people who die. It's not like seatbelts save everybody. There's still people who die, but there are many, many fewer people who die.
In the case of criminal violence, where someone has intent, it's not a spontaneous act, can anything be done other than rendering a gun completely useless in the hands of a determined criminal?
I would say, again, a lot of criminals aren't necessarily determined. What we know is that where guns are easily available, more robbers use guns, and thus there's more deaths from guns and deaths totally in robberies. We know that in every other developed country where it's harder to get for robbers to get guns, for criminals to get guns, there are many fewer deaths by criminals. It's not like they have different intent. It's just they have different means.
Professor, I think we both know that gun rights advocates would say if you change the design of the guns, if you make it more difficult for the guns to be used, and if you change the law to make it more difficult to obtain a gun, then you're affecting my right to bear arms.
The Supreme Court and the courts in the United States have not given individuals a right to own guns. It's currently a privilege. The laws may change or change the interpretation. But secondly, virtually all people, large majority of the American public, a large majority of gun owners, and even a majority of NRA members think that very sensible gun laws can be enacted which will not deprive individuals of their rights to have guns or to use guns.
What do you say to the idea that simply having more citizens carrying guns would serve as an effective method of preventing gun violence?
That's sort of an interesting empirical issue. The evidence seems to show is that where there are more people carrying guns is actually more total violence and particularly more homicides. There's not very little evidence that shows, no good evidence that shows that, for example, shell issue laws or permissive concealed carry laws have any beneficial effect on most crimes or homicide.
But it might make people feel safer.
It might make them feel safer. It's going to make other people feel less safe who don't have the guns. It's going to make it much, much harder for police to worry about criminals who have guns if they don't know whether you're a criminal or not and you're walking around with a concealed gun.
Is there any way, do you imagine, that we'll ever be able to weed out people who do spontaneous acts?
I doubt it. Well, you can try to figure out different ways to reduce the problems. We can really try to reduce bullying, and we should. Evidence indicates that we have no worse a bullying problem in the United States than in other developed countries. Our kids are no more necessarily violent than in other developed countries. They don't see more violent videos than in other developed countries. So they're not really different, but the big problem is they have access to firearms.
David Hemenway is a professor of Harvard School of Public Health and the author of Private Guns, Public Health. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Still to come, painted portraits that remember the U.S. soldiers who've died in Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Diehard fans are there every day, rain or shine. Michael Jackson fans cheering outside the Santa Barbara County Courthouse on day 19 of the pop singer's trial on charges of child molestation. But as reporter Matt Taibbi writes in the coming issue of Rolling Stone magazine, the rest of the country doesn't seem to be paying much attention. Matt joins us on the line. And can you just start by giving us a thumbnail of what a very complicated case?
The gist of the case comes down to that in February 2003, a documentary appeared called Living with Michael Jackson, which was done by a British filmmaker named Martin Bashir. And in it, Michael Jackson admits that he sleeps in the same bedroom with children. And one of the children that was shown in the documentary was the accuser in this case. And the prosecution alleges that what Michael Jackson did is he was afraid that the child was going to come forward with an accusation that Michael had molested him. So the state's case is that Jackson essentially kidnaps the family for a period of about a month, forces him and the rest of his family to appear in a video in which they deny that Michael Jackson ever molested the child. And then, only after they've been kidnapped for a month and forced to do this video, only then does Michael Jackson actually molest the child for the first time.
It's complicated, and as you write, the prosecution's case is flawed. Why?
Well, it doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense. You know, the idea that Jackson and a conspiracy of his handlers would go to such extreme lengths to take this child and three of his family members on this elaborate one-month kidnapping across Southern California that involves stays in luxury hotels, body waxes, and all kinds of bizarre activities that one wouldn't normally associate with kidnapping. The idea that he would do all these things just to get the child to say in a videotape that he hadn't been molested when he actually hadn't been molested, and then only after that does he actually molest the child for the first time when the police are investigating him, it just doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense.
Mm. On the other hand, you also note that, to you at least, observing him in the courtroom, Michael Jackson is one weird dude. I'll use the word dude.
Yeah. He's extremely strange. There was one moment in the trial where the prosecution showed a picture of a mannequin that had been recovered during a search warrant, and it's a life-sized, fully lifelike mannequin of one of Jackson's little cousins that apparently he keeps at his bedside in his bedroom, and the prosecution alleges that Michael simulated a sex act. But the jury was just staring at this mannequin and thinking, what kind of a person keeps a life-sized mannequin of one of his little minor relatives in his bedroom?
Well, in the meantime, even though this trial is obviously incredibly important for those at the center of it, as you paint this picture, it is a pitiful group of people gathering every day. You write, District Attorney Tom Snedden is a humorless creep. There's a hobbit-like, self-promoting British tabloid creature who's also been on the stand. The only sympathetic characters you find are some of the younger people who have been called to testify. Do you think that's why a lot of people are actually not watching this as closely as some might suspect?
I think there are a lot of different reasons why this case is not getting the attention that you would normally associate with a celebrity trial. One is that people don't like to talk about child molestation around the water cooler at work. The other one is that this case is really complicated, as we just went through. It's not something that you can really can sum up in a second or two. The other one is that Michael Jackson is a little bit old. He's old news to an extent. He hasn't had a hit in ages, and he's not exactly a sympathetic character.
And neither is, and as you write, neither is the family of the young boy at the center of the case.
No, the accusers in this case are extremely questionable people.
Well, Matt Taibbi, on Monday, actor comedian George Lopez is expected to take the stand. He's had a negative interaction with the family of the accuser. And it's said that Monday is going to be a big day also because the judge will decide if the prosecution can introduce other boys that the district attorney claims had special relationships with Jackson that just didn't end up in criminal court.
Right.
But given all this, when do you see this trial ending?
There was a very funny moment in the case when during the cross-examination of the accuser, Jackson's attorney, Thomas Mesereau, introduced a piece of evidence. I don't even remember what it was, but he says, Your Honor, I'd like to introduce this exhibit, and he says the number, and it's 5,303. So immediately all the journalists looked at each other, and the ones who were going to be there forever, you know, were groaning to themselves, thinking, my God, we have to sit through 5,000 exhibits when the defense presents its case. So I would imagine that it's going to be 5 months at least.
Matt Taibbi, reporter for Rolling Stone magazine. His article on the Michael Jackson trial is available in the new issue of the magazine. Matt, thanks.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Over 1,500 soldiers have been killed in Iraq since the beginning of the war 2 years ago, and memorials to those fallen soldiers have sprung up around the country. A new exhibit of portraits has just opened at Arlington National Cemetery, and at Syracuse University, student and faculty artists from Syracuse and from the College of Marin in California also painted just over 1,400 portraits in honor of those killed in Iraq. The exhibit is called To Never Forget, Faces of the Fallen. It was organized at Syracuse by art professor Stephen Zima, and recently I asked him to tell us about the artists involved in this memorial.
It's predominantly student paintings, some faculty, staff, artists from the community.
Well, how are your students responding to this? What are they like when they are painting these pictures, and how are they doing the pictures?
Mostly in oil paint, but the two sets are quite different. The College of Marin set, I would say, is more somber, muted tones, monochromatic. Here at Syracuse, we have a large base of students that work in a lot of media, so you have a lot of different styles. Certainly arts is probably more experimental. I ask the people to be respectful of the image and just work two-dimensionally. So you see a very different group of work. On one wall, you see the College of Marin group. That's 96 feet. And then on our wall, which is about 30 feet, you see the remainder. But you can see all of them at one point in the gallery. Mm. So you have this rather cathartic, if not sobering, sort of shock of recognition that just hits you all at once. It's amazing.
How many there are.
Right.
What was it like to paint Army First Lieutenant Adam Malson?
Well, you know, like many of us here, perhaps this is not what we do in terms of portrait painting or that kind of painting, but we're putting our ego, our media, our styles aside, and we're just doing the best we can and trying to make these modest memorials with respect to those that have fallen.
Yeah. What are students saying about this?
I think a lot of them, they know this is a unique project. That's their generation, and they know it, and they feel that. You see that they're so focused. The room is absolutely silent.
Is there a political message here?
Not from me. This is not about politics, and it certainly does not endorse or try to comment on the merits of the war, nor does it try to encompass all of the casualties of this war.
Have you had any soldiers come to see it?
A lot of them. One young man, actually, Anthony Grieve, he's a specialist, and he had just come back from Iraq, and he calls me up, and he says, I'm wondering if my two buddies are up on the wall. And he gave me the numbers, the dates, and I found them, and I said, Anthony, why don't you come to the opening on Thursday night? And he said, I've got to ship out Thursday morning. And I said, well, why don't you come on over the day before? We'll be pretty much installed. So he comes over there, and this young man, I mean, he's built like an absolute brick. I mean, he's just solid as a rock. In his black coat, and he's got his black cowboy hat on, big guy. He comes over, and you could tell he's just welling up with tears when he sees these portraits. He's examining them. He's photographing both sides of them. And I said, Anthony, you know, we're just about to put on all the labels, the name tags. We'd be honored if you'd help us out and maybe start and with your two friends. These portraits were on the bottom row, so he was down on his knees, carefully rubbing the name tag against the wall, rubbing their names. Mm. It was a sight. It was a sight. It was amazing.
Professor Stephen Zima, who organized the To Never Forget Faces of the Fallen, Portraits of U.S. Soldiers Killed in Iraq, currently at Syracuse University. Professor, thanks for talking to us about it.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Well, we turn now to Specialist Anthony Grieve, a helicopter mechanic who served in Iraq and is now stationed in Hawaii, and he joins us on the line. And Specialist Grieve, I'm wondering, first of all, you know, two of your friends who died in the war have portraits in this exhibit. Were you nervous about going to see it?
I was really nervous, but at the same time, when I read the article about the exhibit, I was very anxious and had a sense of being that I had to go there to see it.
Yeah. So, what'd you think when you first saw the portraits?
I was amazed by the amount of hard work and effort, and long hours that were put into painting all the portraits. It was a great show of appreciation for what we do.
It must have had quite an emotional wallop, too.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. How is it different from a photograph?
Photograph, you know, it's, you know, quick, easy thing. You know, just press a button and it takes a picture, and you get the film developed. Like with the paintings, you know, there's a lot more time and time and effort taken, you know, to put in, you know, even the smallest details.
Yeah. Do you mind my asking, what were your friends' names?
The two pilots was Captain Johnson and Chief Warrant Officer Tube Brennan.
Yeah. How'd they die?
Back in October, there were two helicopters that had a mid-air collision over in Iraq. When I first walked in to see the exhibit, you know, I was blown away. You know, and I walked up and down in front of where the exhibit was being shown.
Mm.
You know, just in total awe, and, you know, got a bit choked up.
I imagine. We understand that you were also able to place the labels for the show under the paintings of your two friends.
Mm-hmm.
Some might think that would have a nice ritualistic, you know, effect. What was the effect of that?
I was, how do I explain that? No, it made me feel real good that Mr. Zima, you know, asked me and allowed me to place the names under the portraits of those two pilots. It gave me a great sense of well-being, you know, having known and been close, you know, with working and talking to the pilots. So it made me feel like I had an important role, you know, even though it was something as little as putting their names under the portraits.
Yeah. You did have this personal connection to the exhibit, but I'm wondering what it was like to see all of the, I mean, there's so many, hundreds of them. I wonder what impact that had, just the enormity of it.
When I first went to Iraq, there were only around 500 troops that had been killed, and by the time I left, it was over 13, pushing 1,400. And, you know, seeing all that and, you know, compiled into, you know, a small place, you know, as a memorial, it was really amazing.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say to the artists?
To the artists and everybody who had a part and played a role in putting the display together, I wish I could thank you all personally.
Well, Specialist Anthony Grieve of Unit 125 Aviation Regiment, thanks so much for speaking to us about the exhibit of portraits of those killed in Iraq. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
And the exhibit, To Never Forget, Faces of the Fallen, is on display in Syracuse until April 1st. For more and to see some of the portraits, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, Emiko Tamagawa, Karen Miller-Metzen, Jim Moses, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns, Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here In Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful weekend. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.